Good evening, everybody. I'm your host, Jonathan Moody, and we're Hooked on Hitchcock with my co-host, G. Larry Butler. How you doing, Larry?
Well, gee whiz, pretty good. Yeah, I'm still breathing. That's the main thing.
Gee whiz.
That's I'm the gee whiz kid.
That's a typical, like, 1950s.
I know. Well, I grew up in that era. I don't want to date myself, but the 50s, yeah, all of the 50s, and then some. Anyway, I can ski for free now, so I'm that old.
Ski for free. That sounds wonderful.
Yeah, I know. You can break the hip for free.
Yeah. I would think they'd be more worried about that. Like, all.
Not me. I'm ready to jump out of more airplanes. I did 201 jump. I want to go for 202.
So. Nice. Yeah. All right. So we're here to talk about the movie that, 1943 movie Shadow of a Doubt.
Yeah.
So this is, we decided, did you get my text of the different movies we're going to do this year?
Yes. I just glanced at them because I was just coming back from
So we'll talk about that at the end of the thing and let people know what they can expect, because I'm going to keep to that schedule.
So this is absolutely thrilling for those just tuning in. It's thrilling for me, you know, because I didn't know all this stuff about Hitchcock.
Well, let me read this first, and then you can say your parts that you learned about it. Maybe some of it might be the same stuff or not. I don't know. This is from Hitchcock and Truffaut. So Truffaut asks, I take it that out of all the pictures you've made, Shadow of a Doubt is one you prefer, and yet it gives a rather distorted idea of the Hitchcock touch. I feel that the film is a film which provides the most accurate image of the ensemble of your work, as well as of your style, is Notorious, right? Mm. He said, I wouldn't say that Shadow of a Doubt is my favorite picture. If I've ever given that impression, it's probably because I feel that here is something that our friends, the plausibles and the logicians, cannot complain about. And he's like, what about the psychologists? He's like, that's right, the psychologists as well. It's in a sense, it reveals a weakness. On the one hand, I claim to dismiss the plausibles, and on the other hand, I'm worried about them. After all, I'm only human. But that impression is also due to my very pleasant memories of working on it with Thornton Wilder in England. I'd always had the collaboration of top stars and the finest writers. And in America, things were quite different. I was turned down by many stars. And writers who look down on their noses at the genre I work in. That's why it was so gratifying for me to find out that America's most eminent playwright was willing to work with me, and indeed that he took the whole thing quite seriously. Wow. Then he says, when did Thornton Wilder, did you select Thornton Wilder, or did someone suggest him to you? He's like, I wanted him. But let's go back a little into the history of the picture. Okay, so you're going to hear how it began. A woman called Margaret McDonald, who was the head of Selznick's story department, had a husband who was a novelist. One day she told me her husband had an idea for a story, but he hadn't written it down yet. So we went to lunch at the Brown Derby, and they told me the story, which we elaborated together as we were eating. Then I told them to go home and type it up. In the way we get the skeleton of the story into the 9-page draft that was sent to Thornton Wilder. He came right here to his studio, to this studio where we are in, to work on it. We worked together in the morning, and he would work on his own in the afternoon, writing by hand in a school notebook. He never worked consecutively, but jumped about from one scene to another, according to his fancy. I might add that the reason I wanted Wilder is that he had written a wonderful play called Our Town. Mm. So he said, so Truffaut said, I saw Sam Wood's screen version of the play. When the script was finished, Wilder enlisted in the psychological warfare department of the U.S. Army, but I felt there was still something lacking in our screenplay, and I wanted someone who could inject some comedy highlights that would counterpoint the drama. Thornton Wilder had recommended an MGM writer, Robert Audrey, but he struck me as being more inclined towards serious drama. So Sally Benson was brought in. It says the story of Shadow of Doubt centers on Charlie Oakley, Joseph Cotton, opening with the arrival in Santa Rosa for a visit with the family. The real purpose of this visit is to clue to investigators who are on his trail. The family, we'll talk about the story. I thought I was going to say something about the thing. Before the writing, Wilder and I went to a great pains to be realistic about the town, the people, and the decor. We chose a town that we went there in search of the right house. We found one, but Wilder felt that it was too big for a bank clerk. Upon investigation, it turned out that the man who lived there was the same financial bracket as our character. So Wilder agreed to use it. But when we came back 2 weeks prior to the shooting, the owner was so pleased that his house was going to be used in the picture that he had it completely repainted.
I remember that.
So he had to go in and we had to go in and get permission to paint it dirty again.
Yeah.
And then we were through naturally. We had it done all over with bright new colors.
Yeah, they dirtied it up and then they had to let the grass grow again because they cut the lawns and they fixed a lot of the problems with the wood, the structure of the house. And so anyway.
There's more on it. I don't want to read the whole thing. You know, yeah. There's a lot. We got to talk about our thoughts on it and stuff too.
Yeah. Since you're doing a little bit of the background, could I give a little bit?
Sure.
What I found out? Yeah. I have a personal connection to this movie simply because the guy that plays the father is Henry Travers, who would play Clarence the Angel in It's a Wonderful Life. And then I look a lot like him, except he's got a little bit bigger nose, but basically, and we're the same age. He was 68 when he did this movie with a 7-year-old son. Imagine that.
Yeah.
But also, it was shot in Santa Rosa, and I kind of grew up there. I grew up in Calistoga, which is 18 miles away, and so I went over there a lot of times, and I know the city very well. So it was kind of fun to watch it back in the 40s. You know, it was shot in 43, but made it look like 41 pre-war, so they didn't have to mention the war. And so a lot of things were really cool about that, and they shot in Santa Rosa because Hitchcock wanted to get as far away from Hollywood as he could so he could use non-union actors. And two of them have speaking roles, those two girls that are friends of, the niece, and also a lot of the extras. They're all non-union. So he kind of got away from SAG's jurisdiction that way. And anyway, that was my two thoughts about the making of. But do you have anything more on that? The year it came out, it was a failure. It was a flop at the box office, but it came in at number 81 of all the movies made that year. I didn't even know they had lists like that, but I guess was a bottom grossing picture. But then after that, it was nominated for the top 100 greatest American movies of all time, and it didn't make the list, but it was the 400 that were considered, and then it became part of the National Film Registry, and it was on Roger Ebert's Great Movies list as well.
I saw that.
Yeah, so, and it's actually a true story, based on a true story, right? About Earl Nelson, who murdered many widows over 18 months.
Yeah, that's what I heard too, is that the original writer who came up with the idea had, thought of, I forgot, he was like the gorilla killer or something, like that. I think that was what his,
I can't remember exactly, but his personality changed after a bump on the head from a bicycle accident, and that's what they covered in the film too. It happened to the uncle, so we're getting ahead of ourselves, but anyway, that's part of the plot line.
Yeah, I mean, but that totally, with the idea of basically doing the same, same story.
The idea behind the movie was you always destroy the thing you love. And so the niece ends up destroying the uncle. So that was pretty cool.
Yes, it was based on a true story of Earl Leonard Nelson, a mass murderer of the 1920s known as the Gorilla Man.
So, oh, the 20s, okay. Gorilla Man, yeah. They killed a lot of women. But anyway, in the movies, well, I don't know how much we should give away, but it's less than that. It's just a lesser number that he kills. But anyway, yeah, it opens up at Polanski Skyway Bridge. I thought it was New York, but it's New Jersey, Newark. And it's the bridge that connects Jersey City and Newark. So that was pretty cool. And then, anyway, go ahead, John.
No. I'm just listening.
Yeah, it starts with Charlie in bed, obviously depressed. And then the landlady comes in and, you know, scolds him about leaving money all over the floor. He's got scads of money just everywhere. It's obviously play money too, right? You can tell it's not real money. They didn't use it.
Well, yeah. And I absolutely adore the landlady. I thought she was freaking hilarious.
Yeah.
Throughout it. I don't know who that lady was. I don't know if she was somebody who actually has been in other stuff, but she was just wonderful.
She was good. And they're saying they were theorizing that he probably killed her. Before he left the house, because in real life, the guy would have killed the landlady. Anybody, you know, in that position, he didn't want. But she was really nice, and it was kind of sad.
I don't know. I want to believe that that's not true, because we already had the two detectives investigating.
Right.
If he had actually killed the landlady, they would have the two people would have come across it, and then he would have already been busted for that. So I would disagree with that logic and that thought. So
very astute. Yeah. You know, I didn't know if there were hoods or cops when I first, you know, they kind of, you weren't real sure.
It was right.
Kind of vague, you know, is he being tailed by the mob or are they FBI?
Actually thought from the very beginning it was cops, you know, because I don't know why. Like when I first saw it, I just automatically thought those two guys look like cops. Like, is this guy like, because, you know, whenever you think of Hitchcock, you think of the wrong man thing, right? You know, you think of like, oh man. So I really love this movie because it's sort of the opposite of what he normally does, which is normally does like the wrong guy, you know, person. They have to, the guy has to convince the people that he is innocent when he's that he's he's got to prove his innocence, right? In this movie, the dude's actually guilty, but he has to still prove his innocence even though he's guilty, you know, like he's obviously. And they don't try to, like, nowadays if they try to like remake this movie or something, right, what they would do is they would take it where at the end you wouldn't know whether or not, you know, like, right. Well, did he do it or did he not do it? This movie, they slept flat out pretty much.
I know. That's what I didn't like about the movie. When I first saw it, I thought, this is too obvious. You know, right. make me work for it. You know, give me a mystery here.
But I kind of like that. I kind of like it. I liked it because it was like, well, I respect it now more. Maybe back then I'd probably have been the same way. But like, actually back then when I first saw this movie, I adored it. And I'll get into like more stuff, right, you know, as we go.
I liked it better on this. The second time I liked it. But it should have been called Without a Shadow of Doubt, not Shadow of Doubt.
Without a Shadow.
Without a Shadow. In fact, I read that somewhere. They misnamed it. In fact, they didn't even have a working title. I mean, that was kind of like a temporary title, and he just left it there.
It was a temporary title, yeah. They were just using it as a working title until they figured something else. I've always figured out that's a bad idea to always use something as like your working title better be almost as good as something that would be, you know, because a lot of times people just get lazy at the end and they can't figure it out, so they're just like, oh, let's just keep the name, and you know, this happened with another movie, Robert Rodriguez does that a lot, where he would just like name somebody something, you know, have like just call them something, and then, you know, as a place name, and then he'll just get lazy and be like, I'm just gonna call it, I'm gonna keep him as that. And he said this plenty of times. So my idea is, if you're ever gonna make if you're ever gonna write a movie or direct a movie or whatever, and you're gonna make something, make it where the title is just as good as a possible like real title.
I'm surprised somebody hasn't just called something a working title. You know, just a,
like the movie,
a strange sense of humor.
Funny thing, the movie Almost Famous, the original title was Untitled.
Oh, okay.
And then, so the director's cut was then called Untitled instead of Almost Famous. Yeah. So,
you know, what I really liked is watching Yum Cronin, the neighbor, Herb.
Yeah, he's my favorite.
First dramatic role on screen. Now, he was a stage actor. That was his first time. Hitchcock liked him so much, he brought him back in Lifeboat, which we already reviewed. So that was his first time on screen. And then he became very famous later in life, of course. But he was pretty good. He that's the only time that I was wondering. Remember when they rescued the niece from the garage?
Mm-hmm.
He's overcome with the fumes, and they were thanking him, and they kind of looked down for a minute, like a guilty, like somebody who looked down if they're guilty. I'm thinking, are they trying to red herring here, try to divert her attention?
But I never got that.
I thought, interesting.
I thought his character, and this is an interesting idea, and I don't know if you think about this or not, his character might have had Asperger's and stuff, because that's how I viewed it. I think like his character kind of has that kind of quirky, weird kind of like authentic thing. But back then they didn't have a name for it. I don't think. I don't know if Asperger's was an actual thing. The way I thought was like, because I've known a bunch of people who have Asperger's, and it's not a bad thing or anything. It's just what it is. And the thing is, you watch that movie and there's a he just kind of has this like little, like he does a little weird stuff. He acts a little
There's something peculiar about him and Henry Travers. But they had this peculiar hobby, what they would try to kill each other, theorizing, you know, how would I kill you best, or mushrooms, or you know, strangle you, or this or that. And so that was kind of an interesting distraction.
Okay, so I'm going to bring up something in that, because you brought that scene up, and I'm going to talk about that scene real quick, okay? So there's a couple things I learned. So Hume Crone talked about this. So he said, first of all, I'm going to tell you a couple funny stories. Hume Crone said that this little girl that was around the set for, you know, Shadow of a Doubt, came up to him and asked for his autograph, right? And then he signed her autograph, and it was like, I think his first autograph, you know, so he's really excited. He signed her autograph, and then she looked down at it, read his name, and then said, hurry up and get famous.
Yeah, that's good.
So the other thing he talked about was that there's a scene in that scene in Shadow of a Doubt where daughter Charlie, not Uncle Charlie. That's how I'm going to say it. Daughter Charlie, or the niece Charlie, Uncle Charlie.
Just say uncle and niece.
Whatever. Yeah, the uncle and niece. So the niece, you know, kind of freaks out at her father and Herb, you know, and yells at both of them about talking about, like, because, you know, he says something about I could do poison you with these mushrooms, and he's like, oh, but they'll figure out it was poison, so they'll know, you know, whatever, you have to do this and everything. And she freaks out and yells at them and says, you know, what are you doing, you know, always talking about killing people. And which gave one of my favorite lines from that, which is, we're not talking about killing people, he's talking about killing me and I'm talking about killing him. Right. Good. Which I thought was just fantastic. And like they basically brought like a lot of the comedy to the thing. But Hitchcock got mad at Hume Crone, because Hume, every time the girl would get up and yell at them, he would step back, right? Because he was nervous. and stuff.
Oh,
and so
yeah.
He would keep stepping back. And so Hitchcock kept cutting and said, "You keep moving back, Hume." And Hume was like, "But I'm uncomfortable." And Hitchcock's answer to that, because this is like the third, like they did like three times and he did the same thing, right? You know? And so he says, "Well, all right, so we'll shoot it again. And you stand up and move back, and we'll have a comfortable actor with no head."
Right.
And, you know? Right, yeah. The way that shot, obviously.
It makes sense. Sometimes you have to do things that don't seem natural. I've been in that situation.
Exactly. Yeah. But you said it perfect. No. Okay, can you hear me?
Yeah, I lost you for a second.
Okay. That's okay. Alfred Hitchcock said something to Hume after that Hume would never forget, and this is actually a really great quote. He said, "The camera lies, you know, and when it does, you have to accommodate it."
Yeah, that's right. Very true.
Right. So.
Oh, while we're on Hitchcock, did you see him in the movie?
I did not notice him at the time, but I looked up and saw where it was.
Right. 16 minutes in, he's playing cards in a train. He's got all spades or something, or
yeah,
he's got a straight flush spades. Yeah, so I didn't see it either time.
Yeah, you should focus on the movie. You're not thinking about where's Hitchcock, but that's once again, that's going to be a constant thing in our show. Is we're going to like let people know where they can spot Hitchcock. So it's on the train. And they are playing cards, and you see the cards. So I know exactly where it is. Trains, you know, how many movies has he done where he puts trains? He loves trains. I would love to like have known what his fascination with is it just because it's just easier to film in a train or something, or like.
Well, he loved, who was it, Peugeot or something, the detective, the Murder on the Orient Express. He loved that movie and modeled after some of it. But this one belched black smoke, which was a symbolic of evil and impending evil and mayhem. So that's what somebody wrote. And they thought, yeah, very good. Good point. And I'm thinking, the pollution in that day and age, my God. Did everybody breathe that crap?
It was just... honestly, it was, I mean, there's always so much stuff that Hitchcock puts into his movies that we don't even realize that, like,
And I was also thinking a lot of his characters' expressions, how they express themselves, what they say are his very thoughts. So he speaks through his characters. He's a little quirky that way too. And maybe he hates women. Maybe he is kind of murderous in a way, but
I love the idea or the thought that maybe he gets with somebody that he's friends with and tries to figure out how to kill each other. Like that would be that would be a funny dinner table scene in life.
He was terrified of strangers. I don't know if you told me or I read it, where he didn't even want to walk across the studio floor by himself, that some stranger might approach him. So he always had a vanguard to protect him. Whenever he went to the bathroom, he had somebody accompany him, you know, to kind of straight arm anybody who tried to talk to him.
That's weird, you know. Like, I mean,
kind of bold. Yeah. Really.
I don't know. That always makes me think of you know, the rapper Eminem.
Yeah.
He has a song where he talks about how you know, when I'm in the restroom, don't come and bother me while I'm trying to take a piss.
Well, that's very true.
Yeah, you know, people bother people. He's trying to do is take a leak. And so I imagine like Hitchcock was trying to take leaks at times and people just came in and it's like, "Hey, Hitch," you know.
Well, Paul Newman was taking a piss once and a guy came in and asked for his autograph and Paul Newman turned around and pissed on his shoes. He said, "There you go. There's your autograph."
Oh my God, that's funny. It's fucked up, but it's funny. Teresa Wright. I had never heard of her or anything before this movie.
Me neither.
And I realized she worked. I guess she got her start with William Wyler, right?
Okay.
William Wyler did like Little Foxes and did like Miss Miniver. And did you know, punch of stuff. And she, you know, she worked with him and got her start that way. And then she ended up working on this. And apparently she says this is her favorite movie.
Yes. And, yeah.
I wonder if it's because it's like, it's really her movie, you know, like really.
Right. Like, she starred, well, he co-starred with Cotton, but
yeah, but I think it's really her. Like, even the villain, you know, of the piece.
Well, he's the lead villain. Yeah. But yeah. She's the star. Yeah.
She's the lead hero in a way. Yeah. And I mean, she is a hero. I mean, we're going to do spoilers because hopefully people have already seen this movie. But like, she pushes him off the train at the end, which is amazing, by the way. Like, the fact, I don't know how they did that.
I don't either. That was before CGI.
That was before CGI. And that was before, I mean, what they must have done is like rear projection kind of thing. Yeah, you know, something like that where they shot it at a certain thing where they could shoot two different things. They could shoot the train coming from one thing, and then you could shoot.
They superimposed it, or super, yeah,
super. Yeah, superimposed it somehow or another. Because I don't know how, like, you can see his whole body come out of the train.
Yeah.
So it wasn't even like a stunt person falling. So I don't know how they did that, but however they did it, it was amazing and it looked great. And I could have just imagined people in 1943 going into the theater and seeing that scene going, what the fuck, you know, like, holy crap, you know. Right. Oh, it's insane.
Yeah. It was interesting when he got off the train the first time. He was using a cane. It's like, who's he gonna fool doing that? And then she was kind of shocked, or Denise, when she came. And then he straightens up and walks right, you know, because it was obviously an act. But, and then he hid in that little Pullman section of the train and didn't come out for 2 days. He's coming from east to west on the train. He pretended to be sick. But anyway, let's see what she was obviously smitten with her uncle. It was almost incestuous. Did you notice the sexual chemistry between the two? My God, I thought they were going to kiss at one point.
Oh God, it was awkward, man.
What? I thought,
I'm an uncle.
You're, how incestuous?
And like, I'm an uncle, okay? And I mean, even today I spoke to my niece, you know, we were chatting. She was with my mom and I was talking to them on the phone. And even with that, I was just like, I would not, like, that just made me feel uncomfortable at times.
Yeah. Yeah, especially that scene in the restaurant when he chases her down, when she storms out of the house and he takes her to that bar, and then she shows him the ring. They're both, it's kind of an awkward moment. They're both ready to get into it. And then the waitress approaches and she says this line I love. She says, oh, I'd die for a ring like that.
She says it twice. And so I was like, okay, we get it. You know, we get what you're doing, Hitchcock. You know, you're saying, you know, you're giving the audience.
Well, yeah, they're indicating, he was like hitting us over the head with the clues, and it was a little too obvious, but I love the way they were so awkward. You know, if you've been in a situation where you're ready to really combat somebody and somebody interrupts you and you're like, both like, okay, we got to take 5 seconds here. This idiot has to talk to us before we launch at each other's throats again. And it's just reminiscent of, you know, my past, when you're ready to fight somebody and somebody says, excuse me, you got the time? It's like, fuck you.
Right.
And they're both looking down. God, it's so interesting. But there you go. There's suspense again. The tension. It's so pregnant. It's incredible how he uses suspense in that, like an ordinary situation like that. Char doesn't want the present that he gives her, the ring, at first, and then she discovers it's got initials on it, right? Mm-hmm. And then she said, well, you know, I bet you have secrets. And he says, well, you don't really, it's not good to find out too much. So right away we suspect him of something.
I suspected him the second I saw him. He had the menacing look a lot of times.
Oh, when he hurled the glass. When he threw the glass on the floor, yeah, I didn't really realize you know, he's got a temper.
He's got a temper, and he's, you know, and he was a dick, honestly. Yeah. Like, he had, when he came into the bank and started, like, joking around, I felt really uncomfortable. Like, I thought it was funny, but I was like, oh, God, you know.
No, he had no sense of decorum. He was bitter about life or something, but he loved to be sarcastic and embarrass people in public places. And, you know, he was talking about embezzling. Her father, you know, Denise's father worked in the bank, Henry Travers. So he went in and he said, hey, have you embezzled a little bit today? And everybody looks around. It's like, that was pretty comical. And then when he talked to the bank president, and then the widow comes in, one of the friends of the bank president's wife, while they were in the room, he was investing a lot of money. And she started flirting with him. I thought, oh, God, here we go again.
Well, okay, so I want to talk about that. So the Mary Widow murderers, what he was known as or whatever, or the person was known as, at the end of the movie, they think they caught the guy because I don't know how they thought they caught the guy because there's no proof that the other guy had actually murdered the people, you know, except for the fact that he, I guess, killed himself in order to get away from the cops. Yeah, you know?
That doesn't make him guilty, though.
Yeah, so he's not the actual, like, that guy wasn't the murderer. Obviously, the Uncle Charlie was still the murderer. However, did you notice at the end of the movie when he says he's going to leave town, he's going to go on the train and head out to whatever, that the widow lady said she was going to go there too?
Yeah.
I was like, oh, God, she is just like...
He would have killed her too.
But... You would have killed her and took her money.
Yeah, if he married these women and inherited the money, it wasn't said, or he just killed them and took what money they had on them.
Now I see where people, now I'm starting to think about it. I see where people are saying that he might've killed the landlady, you know, because he did try to kill his own niece, you know, because she knew too much. However, the landlady didn't know too much. All she knew is that he had money. That doesn't necessarily mean that he would have, you know, but I think that might have been where people thought, okay, if he would kill his own niece just to leave town, he would probably kill the landlady too. But me, I think literally it's.
But when the niece said that she had a psychic connection, you know, and she started humming the Mary Widow Waltz, and she asked him what it was, he said, oh, that's a Blue Danube. And then he gets nervous and spills a glass of whatever it is on the table. And I knew then it was lying. And so, you know, it's very fitting, the Mary Widow Waltz. So he had a specialty, and he wooed widows and murdered them.
He kept doing everything he could to get away from people finding out his secret, including the newspaper, tearing up the newspaper and making it into a house. And then his, niece Charlie comes and says, well, you can't, I know there's something that you're hiding from us. There's a secret that's inside the paper. You know, why, you might as well tell me, you know, right.
But he sees it in his pocket, doesn't she? And he makes a paper airplane out of it and tries to destroy it.
He kept trying to like do everything he could. Like you said, like knocking over the drink or whatever in order to get her to, because she was about to tell the song or whatever. No, that's where this is from and stuff. And he he interrupts it basically because he doesn't want everybody else to figure it out, you know. But Charlie is so smart, niece Charlie, she's so smart, she's trying to figure this stuff out before, you know,
like
him. So and my other favorite, like little favorite scene is when she finds out that's because she went to the library. And this was a thing that Alfred Hitchcock really wanted to explore, American small town in this movie. Right. And so you get the cop, the guard, the crossing guard or whatever cop, you know, you get the lady who knows her at the librarian who knows her, you know, like everybody knows everybody in that town, you know? So if there's like a stranger who comes, people are like, who is this guy?
They're so self-important. Remember that, the crossing guard, like Why did you do that? You know, I'm supposed to be taking care of you. And he's lecturing you. And then the librarian said, you have no consideration. Oh my God, she's 2 minutes late. You know, yeah. So stern, and they scold her. And it's so self-important. Like, oh my God, these trivial little positions.
I know. Well, it's so funny because, like, she was the one who almost got ran over, right? Like, you know, for doing that. Like, yelling at her about it isn't going to, like, change that. Yeah. Or anything. Like, yeah. So it was just weird. But yeah, it was very small town America. And then you got the two cops who come in, but they're not, obviously, they disguise themselves not as cops. They disguise themselves as, I guess they're working for a survey or whatever they say. Yeah. They're working for a survey for the typical American average family.
Yeah. Yeah. Ordinary family in an ordinary house.
Yeah.
It was so funny about the mother, you know, I forgot who plays that role, but she was good. About they're trying to get a picture of her baking a cake. And she said, well, I'm not going to crack the eggs until I'm ready. So yeah, and she kept finding excuses why they couldn't take her picture. And then the uncle comes, and of course he doesn't want his picture taken, because he doesn't like his picture. That's the only reason they haven't nabbed him before that, because he's invisible, right?
Right.
He didn't know who it was because he'd never had his picture taken. And so
he had never had his, hey, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. They never had his picture taken. And on top of that, like later on, he does snap the picture and then he gives them the other film, you know, so right.
He demands the roll of film, and then they slip him a phony one just one that's not developed.
And exactly.
So that's what they got him on. They sent it back east.
And they sent it back east and they got him. But that's the weird thing. They got him. They got people who placed him in the scene of the crime and everything. Right. And yet they just gave up at the end.
Yeah, that didn't ring true for me. He was jubilant about it. Like, oh, I'm scot-free now. And then he bounds up the stairs and she's glaring at him. And he turns around slowly. And there she is, boring hole with her eyes right through him. And so he knows she knows. And exactly. At that time, you know, he decides to kill her. To cover his track. So first the stairs, right?
First the stairs, which that was a great shot when she fell off the, you know, through the stair, and then you sort of see him watching, you know, and stuff, and like menacingly looking to make sure if she's okay or she's, you know.
I'm not sure if that was just a warning. Maybe he didn't intend to kill her at that point. I don't know. But and then the second time in the garage, but that was.
He meant to. Which,
it's a miracle she's still alive. I can't. Yeah,
hello.
You're off. Yeah, somehow hey. You're off. Okay.
Right. Am I back? That's good. All right. Good.
And we're back.
All right. Yeah. This internet connection has been terrible this month. So or this like week. So anyway, when Hume Crone walked by, right? So he's walking to the, you know, he sees that he hears that somebody's inside the thing trapped and everything, which made me wonder, like, all he had to do was kick the rock. Like, he couldn't do that. Like, he had to run and tell everybody, like, a dog, you know? Like, because they didn't want him to be the hero. They wanted, because he heard... he heard Charlie yelling, he heard somebody yelling in the garage, right? And really all it was, did you see there's just a rock that was like covering the door so she can open it up?
Right.
And so that's what it was.
Peculiar too.
So why didn't he just kick the rock and go in there and get herself, you know, like it wasn't, you know, it was weird. And he said that there was, he couldn't figure out how to open up the door or something, you know? So like, I don't understand why it was that easy for Charlie.
It was an attempt to mislead us again. I don't know. It was kind of a weak attempt, you know, throw blame with somebody else.
I'm not going to lie. Hitchcock, because it was the 1940s and they didn't have a lot of, they didn't have a lot of money for whatever, you know, and all this stuff. Like that, he used a lot of cheap devices and cheap things that made it look worse. We're gonna do Strangers on a Train at some point, and there's the ending to Strangers on the Train is so bad, so terrible now. Like, you look at that and you're like, this is so fake and awful, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, this wouldn't get away. Or then you look at Psycho was great if they just ended with him getting caught and everything, but they had to tack on that extra ending to explain everything. So, like, he uses these little devices that make the scenes worse in a way, or whatever, in my mind.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I love the fact that the villain, the uncle, kind of explains at some point why he hates women. You know, and he feels that don't deserve the inheritance that they get from their poor husbands. You okay?
Yeah. Just dropped.
And they, you know, they work themselves to death, an early death, and then the wives eat, drink, and, you know, enjoy their money but he's so cavalier about people's feelings. He has no empathy. He must be a sociopath. And at some point I wrote it down. Oh, here it is. Husbands spend lives working, making money, so when they die early, their silly wives get it and eat, drink, and gamble the money. Proud of jewelry, but nothing else. Horrible, faded, fat, greedy women. And then his niece says, but they're human. And uncle says, are they? Or are they fat, wheezy animals? What happens to animals when they get too fat and too old? So I knew right there, my God, he's vicious woman hater. And maybe Hitch was too in some regard.
I don't know. I don't necessarily know he like felt exactly that way, but he is notorious for being sort of a dick to his actresses, you know, or whatever. Mostly because here's my opinion on it, you know, and my thoughts, because I don't know him and I don't know, like, these are just my thoughts. These are not accurate facts for anything. These are just based on different documents on Hitchcock and how he treats his women. But a lot of times I feel like he's had feelings for some of these actresses, you know. Yeah. He's had like crushes, or he's like, you know, wanted to mess around, but he lives by like the code of like conduct of like, you know, not fucking up his marriage and being, you know, being very faithful to his wife. So instead of like doing that, he just treats the women badly because he can't, you know, because he can't.
Yeah, he's rejected. You
know,
he's
jealousy a little bit, or whatever. Like, you know, maybe that's a good reason I'm single. I don't know. I you know, like, because I mean, once you get married, that's it. You know, you can't, you know, flirt, or I mean, you can flirt as long as it's harmless, harmless flirting, you know, like as long as your wife is okay with that, comfortable with that.
Yeah.
You know, if your wife's not comfortable with whatever. And I think, but there is a movie, if you watch this movie called The Girl, you know, it's about Hitchcock and Tippi Hedren and the making of The Birds, and how awkward. And I think it does The Birds, and I think it also does a little bit of Marnie, but like that, I mean, he was terrible to his, I'll try to watch it again before we do the next thing. And I can talk a little bit more about that. But it was, I mean, he's just a little creepy at times, I think. And I don't know if he really meant like that, or if he's just, that's just how he was, you know, or whatever, you know what I mean? Like, sometimes people can't help who they are. I mean, they can try to change, but you know, it's hard. You know what I mean?
So. Yeah. I love the psychological thriller aspect of it. But they, you know, how he analyzes, or allows us to analyze the uncle. The uncle says, you know, the world is a sty. Rip the fronts off houses, you find swine. World's hell. What does it matter what happens in it? And another, when he was in the bank, he said, you know, it's all a joke to me. But he's got a very bitter kind of a how their attitude about the whole thing, about life itself and everybody in it.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's so much to this, the psychological study. Now, when he gets ready to leave, she, after the garage incident, he turns on the car in the garage and removes the key, and that's how he tries to kill her. But then she's rescued, and then they end up at the train. But right before that, she's upstairs. She finds the ring in his room, and he does a lecture, which she doesn't attend because she wants to stay home and recover from the, you know, the exhaust fumes. But actually, mm-hmm. she's looking for that ring, and which would prove his guilt. And mm-hmm. The town celebrates him, comes home, fooled by his phony persona. He's brave, generous, kindly, and he's actually hateful, distrustful of murders, but everybody thinks he's such a charmer. She finds the ring, takes it downstairs, and he's about to make a toast, and he looks at her, and he sees the ring on her finger, and he says, I've decided to leave town tomorrow morning. And then right there, I mean, we know that he's going to do something, you know, before he leaves, and mm-hmm. he tries to hurt her on the train. My God.
Yeah, oh my God. So yeah, when I first watched that scene, I was not expecting that at all. You know, I was expecting him to leave and then probably would get a PS on him killing the widow lady, you know, again. That's what I thought was going to happen, you know. But then he invites the girl to come up on the thing and on the train, and then the train starts moving and she's trying to get off the train. And so she tries to push her off, and then she ends up pushing him off and everything. And people were always shocked at how like hard she pushed him, you know, because that is her uncle, you know, like, or whatever. But like,
point. You know, I was struck by that, how she turns on him. Like she's so in love with him. And then she's just so hateful. It's like, boom.
Well, I mean, if you think
there's no transition. So I had problems with that. It's like ice cold. She's hot for him, and then she's ice cold. It's not just a gradual deterioration of their relationship.
So I think it was. I think it was a little bit. But you also have to, you have to take into consideration who she is as a character. You know, I think it was perfect transition because, okay. And you know, and correct me if you think I'm wrong on this or something.
But I just have an opinion.
My opinion on it is that she is at first she's stuck in this rut. She thinks like there. I mean, and the rut isn't really that much of a rut, is it? You know, like they're just. The thing with her is she's just not happy, you know, or whatever. And she thinks that her uncle will be the source of her happiness, right? Which goes into a lot of people's talk these days about what makes us happy. People don't make us happy. You know, right. Other people don't make us happy. We have to make ourselves happy.
Right.
So maybe that's a little bit of what Hitchcock was trying to go with that. So he comes in and takes over and becomes a big part of her life again, right?
Yeah.
And she's happy. She's extremely happy. Things are good. And then she hears quickly, like that her the uncle that she's loved, that she like has this connection with, might be a killer, you know, right? So she doesn't want to believe it at first, you know, right? She has no thought, no interest at all of believing it.
I can't hear you.
All right, there you go. All right, now I can hear you. So
I think
anyway.
You're right.
No. Well, so what I'm saying is like, so the whole time she's like being, trying to be convinced that she, you know, by the cops, everybody else, that this guy is this horrible person. And so quickly she starts formulating in her head. Yeah. Like this guy is a potential psychopath. And she kind of gets like the feeling that he is when they go out to dinner. You know, that scene was not just the idea of like, I would die for this ring. That scene was like it. That was the scene where the catalyst of them of her deciding she was not going to
do before she left the house. But there's an old saying that there's no fury like a woman scorned. Now, hell has no fury like a woman scorned. She loved him, and then that happened. She realized he's a murderer, so she just, it's hate now. So love to hate. So maybe you're right on that. Yeah, you can just snap like that.
You can. And I honestly, you know, like I thought it was like that. I thought that it was really well done, in my opinion, that she was, she just switched because it wasn't, to me, it wasn't that like that quick, you know. It was like she heard all these things. She did not believe it. And then all of a sudden.
I remember the scene with the detective when they were arguing. But I thought that was a little strange, too. Oh, damn. I'm sorry about the phone.
No, it's fine.
Okay. So she was arguing with the detective about, well, you're lying to me. You know, why are you telling me all these things? You know, that can't be true. And she was defending him. So, yeah. So there was transition.
Okay. There you go.
But she never had doubts after that. It's just like when from one extreme to another, right?
Exactly. Defending him
to attacking him. She said, I'll kill you myself if you don't leave. Remember?
Right.
That one line. Whoa. So, yeah, she was very hateful after that.
She was. I mean, because she did not trust this guy, you know. Probably because if he would lie to her, you know, not tell her what was going on or whatever at all, then obviously, like, he was not who she thought he was, you know, and that trust was broken. And that was the bond that they had a lot, is trust, you know, and everything. And all of a sudden she couldn't trust this guy. And so she didn't want him there. She, you know, at one point he said he was going to leave. And then when he realized he got away with everything, he was going to stay. And that really pissed her off, you know, because that's breaking trust. Like, she trusted that he said, okay, I'll leave in a couple of days. Just let me make sure your mom knows I'm going to leave, and, you know, all this stuff. So, I mean, I don't know, but I didn't think, so I thought when she pushed him at the end, I mean, she was saving herself, you know, I mean, she was trying to kill her. So, you know, I mean, it was great. It was like all of it, this whole film. And I want to go on record because I thought Suspicion was like my favorite of like the, you know, this is killing me, man.
Yeah.
I'm open. Yeah.
There's something wrong with your equipment.
No, it's not my equipment. It's the internet connection.
Oh, okay. One other thing, when she's in the garage with the detective and he's professing his love for her, I thought that in argument, I was like, oh God, this is so
okay. Hold on, can you go back? Because you just did the same thing I did, where I can't hear you.
Oh, because I didn't hear you say it. Yeah, that didn't ring true for me at all. But maybe back in those days, you could fall.
No. I had a note about that. Hitchcock is a very known. Remember Suspicion? How quickly did they get married? You know, or whatever.
Those were the days. You know, different moral code.
I don't think that was the days. I think that's just Hitchcock. Like, because it's easier to tell a story where you have the people fall in love very quickly rather than showing gradual time and then fall. You know what I mean? Like, they don't have time to do that. They have to do it quickly. That it becomes this problem of, like, yeah. I'm not going to try to do that in my movies, but, like, that's what they did. That's what they used to do, I guess. I don't know. At least Hitchcock used to. Okay.
But all in all, it was a very good film. I enjoyed it.
It was one of my favorites. I think I would say this is higher than Suspicion in my mind. I like this more. Like, I think after rewatching Suspicion when we did, I thought it was okay, but there was a lot of problems with it. You know, this movie didn't really have that. I mean, if the biggest problem is that she kind of changed real quickly, then that's not really that much of a problem to me, you know. I mean, this was a pretty flawless film in my opinion.
Okay.
You know, it's very funny. The dark humor I loved, you know. Yeah. Like, I wish they could have made a movie with just the father and the friend. Like, I would have watched that, like a whole movie where all they're doing is talking about killing each other, how they're going to kill each other and stuff. Like, that would be a comedy I'd watch, you know.
Too late. Well, you can make one.
I have actually I think I wrote a I wrote an idea. I don't know if I ever put it into a film or not, but an idea of some people doing that in like a but the problem is nowadays everybody thinks of Scream, you know, with stuff, and Scream kind of did that, you know. They have the bit like, how could you kill me, you know, how would you die in a horror film, you know, kind of thing, you know. So I don't know, it's one of those things. So I absolutely I adored this movie a lot more than I remembered. I'm glad we got to see it. I'm glad I got to rewatch it, revisit it. It's probably something I'm going to revisit every year if I can, you know.
Yeah,
I'd love to introduce more people to it, you know. And that's why I think that's mainly why I created Hooked on Hitchcock in the first place, is to talk about films that like not a lot of people talk about these days. Like, everybody talks about Psycho, everybody talks about North by Northwest, everyone talks about Vertigo, you know, Rear Window, The Birds, but nobody talks about Shadow of a Doubt that much. Like, you don't hear, unless it's talking about obscure Hitchcock films, nobody ever talks about it because I mean, it's just not, it's not as famous, you know.
I'm looking forward to more of the same because I'm so glad we did this, because I never would have seen other than the obvious, you know, the big five or whatever, but I'd like to see them all now.
Well, that brings me up to my next thing, because we're going to be closing this episode down in a second, but I want to let everybody know the projects, the next episodes that we're going to do. So we did January, we did Suspicion. February, we did Lifeboat. You can hear me, right, sir?
Yeah, I can.
Okay, good. I'm going to just go like you were, like, I can't hear you.
I will.
If that happens again, because I have no idea. All right, so
Suspicion, Lifeboat.
Hello? Okay, now you can hear me. Yep, I can hear you now. All right. So Shadow of a Doubt, Dial In for Murder is in April, which I'm excited about because I have the biggest crush on Grace Kelly. Like, she was my favorite of all the Hitchcock women that he had. May will be Notorious, and we'll be joined by a guest on that one. I won't say who, but okay. I have a guest that I'm going to ask for that one because it's their favorite film, you know. Somebody
Notorious, hopefully.
In my mind, yes. Then June is Trouble with Harry, which I'm excited about too because I really love that movie. That was a lot of fun. July is Strangers on a Train, which we briefly talked about how that or whatever. Now August, I'm trying to figure out, and we'll talk about it afterwards. Under Capricorn is really hard to like find, you know. So we'll have to see how that works. September is Spellbound, and October is I Confess. So those are the 10 movies that we're doing. We've already done 3, so we got 7 more to go, and I'm very happy about that. I think this was so far this has been a great podcast, you know, like examining the work of and our thoughts, you know, on Hitchcock, you know, and his films and everything. So is there anything that you're up to, Mr. Butler?
In my own private life?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I'm about ready to shoot 2 or 3 films and, you know, looking forward to that. One in Las Vegas.
Wow. When?
End of March, I believe.
Whoa. I'm going to be in Vegas at the end of March.
That's it's called funny. Night of the Zomghouls. So come on over.
I'll let see. You know. Yeah. We'll so, see. It's was it March 28th, I think, is when I'm gonna be.
Oh, well, that's right around the time. Yeah,
somewhere. Yeah, because I'm traveling back to Virginia, so I'm gonna be
it might, we might miss each other, but it's 22nd through 26th, I think. And then I have to go back to LA for the end of Clown Motel 2.
Oh, nice.
I'm playing a second part in the movie. I play two different people. One, a crazy high priest of the clowns, and then another one's just a regular priest later on. And then Compatible, we're finishing that movie. And then I've got three or four other ones. It's like all of a sudden, boom, 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 boom. And I got my first vaccination, so I'm ready for my second one. And so I'll be I'll be cootie free. And I won't hopefully get sick. So anyway, these masks are getting a little hard on my nose and mouth. But I know it's important to do it. So anyway, yeah, but I really look forward to this with you more than anything.
Yeah.
Because this is so much fun. And you're fun.
I know. Like, it's so funny because I had, what is it? We had you for another show. We did a video show with you and Bonnie, and it was completely different, you know? So, yeah,
I know.
but this one is like a lot more, you know, fun. So I think this is something more up what you want to do, you know?
So more intellectual in some respects, and I kind of miss stuff like that, you know, but I'm sure a lot of people out there that need to know about this, because they'd probably like to hear an analysis of Hitchcock too, and comment, you know, and send you comments about this.
Yeah, maybe if people are interested, like people are like into this stuff, like tell us what you guys think, because you know, I'd like to know, like, do you guys feel the same way? You know, did you guys feel like this wasn't? I get it. All right. So, we're probably gonna have to end it now. This is driving me nuts.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't know why it's been acting like this today, but it's been doing it a lot lately. So when I get back to Virginia, I hope my internet is a lot better out there.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. All right. Well, you stick around for a second, and everybody else, thank you guys so much.
What? So would you rate this film? 5 stars?
Oh, did we do ratings on this one?
Well, we did last one. I don't know.
Okay.
I guess you obviously.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, I'd be 4.5 stars.
Yeah, well, I'll match you.
4.5? Yeah, it's a great. Out of 5, it's a fantastic movie. Yeah. It's a lot of fun, and the characters are just, you know, maybe there's a couple little flaws, but, like, really, like, this is almost flawless.
It's just minor things.
Yeah. This is like so far the perfect thing, but I don't know, man. All the other ones that are coming up, maybe we'll think differently. Like, maybe we'll think something else better, you know, or just as good. So
have you seen them all before, or you've seen most of them?
I've seen, let's see, which one have I seen? I mean, all of, I have seen all of these that we're doing.
Oh, I see.
But yeah, no, there's a couple that I want to do later that I haven't watched yet, you know. And that'll be even more fun because I'm going to wait till we watch them for the first time for me to, you know. Yeah. Can you hear me?
There it is. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to keep you on here, but everybody else, thank you guys so much for listening. Tune in next month when we talk about Dial In for Murder.
Right. Until that time, folks, see you then.
See you then. Bye.
Bye-bye.